So here it is, Merry Christmas. Everybody is having fun. Look to the future now. It's only just begun. Who sang that? Go on. You don't know. Slade, yeah, that's right. I'm going to read it to you again. Sorry, it's probably going to be in your head for a week now, but I've got a point to make. So here it is, Merry Christmas. Everybody's having fun. Look to the future now. It's only just begun. I think that kind of encapsulates a lot of people's attitudes to Christmas. It's effectively a kind of blind optimism, isn't it? It's Christmas. Let's have fun. Everything is bright. Everything is joyful. What a message to bring to people who might be in Syria or somewhere very difficult. Here it is, Merry Christmas. Everybody's having fun. Well, everybody isn't having fun. So what's it all about? Is it just blind optimism, or is there more? What does the Bible have to say? Well, maybe at first sight, not a lot more. We have angels giving great news, good news of great joy. We have angels singing, we have Mary reacting in a great way, but what about evil? What if you're not having fun? What if the future doesn't look that bright? What about that? Is Christmas just an empty message of blind optimism, or is there more here? Because we live in a world where everybody isn't having fun. We live in a world where looking to the future might not seem very exciting. Let's see what we have to see in our passage as we read the account of Jesus' life in Matthew's Gospel. The scene here moves away from the manger, it moves away from the shepherds, it moves away from the scene of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. We've seen some great reactions to Jesus' birth. We've seen Mary, we've seen Elizabeth in Luke, we've seen the shepherds praising God, we've seen the wise men bringing the gifts, we've seen angels bringing tidings of great joy. But now this story takes a slightly more sinister turn. We've seen that this boy will be a great man. We've seen celebrations and worship. We've seen that Jesus reveals the glory of God, but now also we see opposition to Jesus. So what happens in our passage? Well, the wise men have come just before our verses. They've brought their gifts and they've gone away. And then we have this miracle, which is that Joseph is sleeping. If you've had a small baby, then you'll realize that it's a miracle that Joseph is asleep at this point. That's a joke. The real miracle, of course, is that an angel comes to Joseph again in a dream and tells him to get up straight away and flee, run away to Egypt during the night. So verse 14, they get up. Still, it seems, during the night. This message must have been pretty urgent. Joseph wakes up Mary. He gets up Jesus. Herod wants to kill Jesus, so they run away, they fly away to Egypt. And then in verse 15, Matthew quotes from Hosea, from the Old Testament. He says, "Out of Egypt I called my son." And that's from the Old Testament. So meanwhile, in verse 16, Herod, King Herod sat in his palace. He's presumably waiting there for the wise men to come back and tell him exactly where Jesus is. He's been outwitted, and he realizes that they've outwitted him. And then shockingly and horrifically, he orders his soldiers to kill all the baby boys in Bethlehem. And again, Matthew links us to the Old Testament, to what the prophet Jeremiah says in verse 18. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." Rachel was a lady in the Old Testament. She was the wife, one of the wives of Jacob, the ancestors of the Israelites, and Rachel was buried in Bethlehem. So that's the link. So why does that's what we've seen. Why does Matthew tell us this story in the first part of our passage? Well, firstly, there is an enemy, an evil enemy, who is opposed to Jesus. There is an evil enemy who is opposed to Jesus. There is great evil here. Herod is determined to kill Jesus. We know from other sources, other historical sources, that Herod killed his own wife, three of his own sons, his mother-in-law, his uncle, and his brother-in-law, in order to secure his throne. So it's not really too surprising what he does next. He can't identify exactly who Jesus is, so he tries to ensure Jesus' death by ordering the death of all the boys of a similar age around Bethlehem. That is evil. We're talking about little babies, little toddlers like ours, being killed, the whole community, their children, their young baby boys wiped out. That is evil. So evil is real, we see here, and evil is totally opposed to Jesus, and evil has no regard for others. So if we could summarize Matthew chapter 1 as the glory of God being revealed at Jesus' birth, having this glimpse into heaven, if you like. We see these angels singing. We see this glimpse of the glory of God. Now we have a glimpse of something else, a glimpse of something very different, a glimpse of the horrific nature of evil that kind of flares up at the time that Jesus is born. And it finds its head in Herod, doesn't it? Herod cannot tolerate any threat to his rule. He couldn't tolerate the idea that someone else might rule over him or instead of him. Well, what about you? Can you tolerate that idea? Who is your king? How do you react to Jesus? Well, okay, we're not going to kill anyone in reaction to Jesus, likely. But are you repulsed by the idea that someone else might be in charge of your life? Do you react with anger like Herod did, that there might be a new king around? What we need to do is worship Jesus as king, like the wise men did, and not struggle vainly against his rule like Herod did. For us, it's not an overt kind of obvious anger, maybe, like Herod's was, but maybe it's reflected in the way we spend our time. Maybe it's reflected in our attitudes, in our conversations, in our priorities, or in the way that we spend our money. Who is your king? Is it Jesus, or is it yourself, like Herod thought? But there's something, I think, darker going on here. Behind Herod, there is another enemy who hates Jesus and opposes God's plans. That ancient enemy, the serpent, the devil, is another enemy who hates the idea of God's king, and that is Satan. He will stop at nothing to try to thwart God and to hurt his people. So there is an evil enemy who is opposed to Jesus, but secondly, God is sovereign. God is sovereign. Matthew wants us to see, I think, that God is sovereign. So verse 12, just before our passage, God warned the Magi in a dream not to go back to Herod. Verse 13, he warns Joseph in a dream. Again, God is one step ahead of Herod, it seems. But actually, God is 1,000 steps ahead of Herod, because Matthew reminds us of these prophecies, doesn't he, in verse 15 and in verse 18. You see, God had had these prophecies written hundreds of years before Herod was even born. God knew exactly what was happening. God had already planned all of this. God is in control. Jesus is the king, and no earthly king could challenge his reign. So in the face of this great evil here, God was in control. In the face of great evil, we can trust God. He is sovereign. He is in control. He has a plan for good. We read elsewhere in the Bible that God works all things for the good of his people. It's not that God was just making the best of a bad situation at this point. No, this was God's plan. He was in control. So God is sovereign, but also God foretold these things. Matthew is quite clear, wants us to see the fulfillment of prophecy. Here we have lots of Old Testament quotes in a short space of time. Verse 15 comes from Hosea. Verse 18 comes from Jeremiah. And we have another one a bit later on. And this is showing that this is part of God's salvation plan. Jesus didn't just escape by chance. This is part of God's plan. That was how it was supposed to happen. Even when things seemed to go wrong here, God knew and God planned it in advance. Evil does not ultimately triumph. And that sets the scene for the rest of Jesus' life, if you like, and for the crucifixion to come. There is constant opposition to Jesus. There is a point where the crucifixion happens, where wicked men put Jesus to death, and it looks as though evil has triumphed. But actually, the crucifixion accounts are also littered with Old Testament quotes, where the point is being made that this is God's plan, that Jesus is fulfilling prophecy in his life and in his death. So we can trust God, even when things look like they've gone wrong. He knows in advance. He knows what will happen in 2016. He knows what will happen tomorrow. And we need to remember that when we get there. God is sovereign. God is in control. And then let's look in a bit more detail at verse 15, which Matthew quotes. One of the prophecies gave us the title of the sermon this morning. Verse 15, out of Egypt I called my son. Matthew quotes from Hosea. That's Hosea chapter 11. And maybe we should turn there because it might help us. So Hosea is just after Daniel. If you flip back, if you have a blue Bible, Hosea chapter 11 is on page 908. And where Matthew quotes is from verse 1 of chapter 11. It says, this is God speaking, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. And then it goes on, but the more they were called, the more they went away from me. They sacrificed to the Baals, and they burned incense to images. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms, but they did not realize it was I who healed them. So originally, the passage that Matthew is quoting in Hosea, God is talking about his people, Israel, as a group of people. He's saying it's as if Israel was my child, my son. And God says he called them out of Egypt. He rescued them from slavery in Egypt. But they were a rebellious child, weren't they? Verse 2, they didn't listen to God. The more he called them, the more they went away from him. The more I called Israel, the further they went from me. They sacrificed to false gods. Verse 3, God taught them to walk like a little child, caring for a little child, but they didn't respond. But now Matthew applies the first part of that to Jesus. You see, Jesus is God's actual son. This is literally God calling his son out of Egypt. But it's not just a geographical, Jesus was in Egypt, therefore the prophecy is fulfilled. I think there's a bit more going on here. Jesus is being identified with the people of Israel. Matthew is identifying Jesus coming out of Egypt with Hosea talking about God bringing the people of Israel out of Egypt. So geographically, Jesus follows the same path that the people of Israel did, coming out of Egypt and coming back to Israel. But spiritually, there's a hint of something else going on here, a hint of Jesus representing his people, a hint perhaps of substitution. You see, where Israel rebelled against God, Jesus will not. And where Israel deserved punishment, Jesus did not. But Jesus was punished so that his people could go free. Israel came out of Egypt, were called out of Egypt by God, and they came out of Egypt to a history of disobedience. But Jesus was called out of Egypt to a life of obedience. See, where they failed, he succeeded. And in doing so, he worked salvation for them. Jesus is the Son of God who saves his people. Now let's move on to the second part of our passage back in Matthew. So we've seen Herod ordering the death of the baby boys and Mary and Joseph escaping to Egypt. And then later on, Herod, we learn in verse... Or is it verse 19? Herod has died. So much for Herod trying to kill God's king. Herod dies, so his kingdom didn't last. Whatever he tried to do, however angry he got, in the end he died. His kingdom didn't last. Then verse 20, God again sends an angel to Joseph in a dream and says, get up, take the child and come back to the land of Israel. This is God calling his son out of Egypt. And verse 21, they come back from Egypt. But verse 22, Herod's kingdom has been divided. So the history of this part of the world at the time of Jesus is quite confusing. But Herod, there's about seven people who have all are called King Herod as well, which makes it more confusing. But basically the Herod that was around when Jesus was born, he was called Herod the Great, and he ruled over most of Israel and Judah and a few other bits as well. But he was very much the king that the Romans had sort of sponsored. And then when he died, the kingdom that he had was split up between lots of different people, some of whom were his children. The king who is now ruling over the part where Bethlehem is called Archelaus or Archelaus, which we hear in verse 22. And Archelaus had a reputation for being even more cruel than his father, than Herod. So understandably, when Joseph finds out that this is the case, he's frightened. And in verse 22, he's warned in a dream by God again. And he goes further north to Nazareth. So Nazareth is now ruled over by a different king. So it makes sense that that's a sensible thing to do. Although before it was all ruled over by Herod. So you wouldn't have escaped Herod by moving about. Now there are lots of different parts of this kingdom. So you escape from Archelaus by going back to Nazareth. And Nazareth is, we know, where Joseph and Mary were originally from. So it makes sense for them to go back there. And Nazareth is now ruled by someone else called Herod Antipas, who incidentally is going to be the Herod who puts John the Baptist to death. So that's what's going on in the background, if you like. There's all these kings, but God, in the midst of all these changing kingdoms and changing things, God is revealing his true king in the midst of all these power struggles. God is, if you like, effortlessly protecting the true king. So what do we learn through this section? Well, I think we learn the same things again. So again, there is an evil enemy who is opposed to Jesus. Verse 22, there's still an evil enemy who is a threat, it seems, to Jesus, to God's king. And he's cruel and opposed to God. But again, God is sovereign. Verse 22, God again warns Joseph in a dream. He's still sovereign. He's still in control in the face of this evil king. God is not thwarted by these evil kings. Joseph might have been surprised when he found out that Archelaus was ruling over Bethlehem, but God was not surprised. God knew, God knows, and God is in control. And again, God foretold these things. So Matthew links us to the Old Testament, to the prophets in verse 23. He says, So as they went back to Nazareth, so was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. So it's not quite clear. The Old Testament doesn't have those words in it. He would be called a Nazarene. So it's not quite clear what Matthew is trying to point us to specifically. Some people think that he might be talking about Isaiah chapter 11, which talks about a branch coming from the line of Jesse. And that's a passage about the Messiah. And I'm told that the word Nazarene sounds a little bit like the Hebrew word for branch. But maybe AD can confirm that, or not. But it doesn't matter if we're not sure exactly which passage Matthew is quoting here. The point is that, again, he's saying the Old Testament is being fulfilled here. God's plan is coming true. God didn't call Joseph and Mary and Jesus back from Egypt and then suddenly think, oh no, Archelaus is king. I hadn't realized that was going to happen. No, God is still in control. He knew, he planned that Jesus would go back to Nazareth and be called a Nazarene. God is not desperately moving Jesus around the place to keep him safe. God planned this in advance. It's maybe a bit like when you go on a long train journey and you have a few changes and you get off the train and you're in an unfamiliar station and you're thinking, I have no idea where I'm going, and you just manage to find the right platform, and then you realize it's not the right platform because the train's coming in a different one, and you go to the next one. It's not like that, where you just kind of by the skin of your teeth you feel you actually manage to get your connecting trains. It's more like a train journey that you've done lots of times before and you know exactly what you're doing. When I was in Belgium, I used to get the train back quite regularly, and I would know exactly where I had to be, which underground line I was going on, and I'd just walk around, and everyone else would be running around, and I'd be thinking, I know exactly where I'm going. It's more like that. It's more this kind of image of God is in control. All these moves are planned. This flight to Egypt is planned just at the right time. This coming back is planned just at the right time, but not to Bethlehem, to Nazareth. It's all planned. God's foretold it in advance. He's in control. Jesus is the true king. It's not whoever the king of Egypt was. It's not Herod. It's not Archelaus. It's not Herod Antipas. It's Jesus. So, do we, as Christians, have a philosophy of blind optimism at Christmas? No, we don't. The Son of God, Jesus, faced real evil. God has called his son out of Egypt. It's like a reenactment of history, God calling Israel out of Egypt, God calls Jesus out of Egypt, only this time it will be different. This son will not be rebellious and turn away from God. This son will be perfectly obedient to his father. He will be vehemently opposed by evil men, not just here but throughout his life. They'll try to throw him off a cliff. They'll try to stone him to death. Eventually they'll arrest him. And they'll bring him before the Roman governor, another king, if you like. And Jesus will say to him, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above." God is still in control, and Jesus is put to death on a cross. But that is part of God's plan, so that he could take the punishment that we deserve, the punishment that his people deserved for rebellion against God, like we read in Hosea 11, so that they could be set free. But even death couldn't hold him. He rose again from the grave. So King Herod's plan to kill Jesus would never have worked anyway, because death could not hold Jesus, God's son, God's king. And he is seated in heaven now, and he will come back to claim his kingdom one day. You see, that's what it means when it says the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not overcome it. Jesus is the light, and evil could not overcome him. He defeated death instead. So the question for us, from what we read here, I think, is which king will you choose? Will you choose yourself, like Herod tried to do, or will you choose Jesus, like the wise men did a little bit before our passage? How will you respond to the king? Like the Magi who bowed down, who worshipped Jesus as king and God? Or like Herod, who couldn't tolerate the idea of someone else ruling over him, who struggled vainly in his anger, and eventually, verse 19, he died. He couldn't keep hold of his kingdom. He couldn't even keep hold of his own life. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you that your word is realistic. Your word is not like a Slade Christmas song with its blind optimism. Lord, thank you that your word deals with evil, and thank you that Jesus came and that he faced real evil, and that he didn't just face it and get away unscathed, but he defeated death, and ultimately death couldn't hold him. Lord, thank you that Jesus is alive today, that Herod's plan failed, that it never had any hope of succeeding, because you are in control. And even in the face of great evil, thank you that we can trust you, we can know that you are in control. Thank you that we can know that whatever happens on the face of this earth, whatever happens to us, we can know that one day Jesus will come back again to claim his kingdom. And that on that day there'll be no doubt who is king. There'll be no one thinking that they are king. There'll be no one thinking Herod is king. There'll be no one thinking the Romans are king. But every knee will bow at the name of Jesus. Amen.